dwelling in the darkest depths of the mind. It's time for Mark D. Valenti and Brain Burrow.
Hello, everyone. This is Mark D. Valenti, and this is another episode of Brain Burrow. This is an episode where we dig deep with our guest, and he has a chance to really share about his personal life, his motivation, his fears, his values, what he wants for himself. And then you, as the listener and viewer, have a chance to assess that and say, how does this relate to me? So I'm very pleased to have on the show today Mr. Bill Oberst Jr., and I want to hand it over to Bill by asking the big open-ended question, who exactly is Bill Oberst Jr.?
Well, the question for people who don't know who I am is, who the hell is Bill Oberst Jr.? I get that a lot. I'm an actor. That's my profession, and it's also my vocation. I am a servant at heart. I like to not please people, but I like to help people. I like to make them feel better. I'm constitutionally set up to try to make people feel better. So in my work as an actor, I always want to entertain people, to lift them up. I don't want to shove things down their throat. I just want them to feel that life is tolerable and that life could actually be okay. That's what I try to do with all of my work.
That's a great answer, Bill. I mean, it's clear you're very passionate about making people feel good. And I'm wondering, where does that come from? Why is that so important to you?
Oh, hell, I don't know. I mean, if I speculated, I would be self-absorbed, which I don't like to be. I was raised in the South, so you never talk about yourself. I don't know. It's just always the way that I've been. I've always enjoyed. I felt like a misfit growing up. I play monsters for the most part in my work on film and television. I didn't in stage, but I do on film and TV. And so I've always been drawn to misfits and lonely people, wounded people, particularly wounded monsters, I call them. But as I've grown older, I found out that everybody is wounded. And so that makes the whole world my friend. I'm no longer afraid of anybody because we're all just wounded monsters. And nobody has any claim to be a higher form of wounded monster than anybody else. It's very liberating, actually, to realize that we're all wounded. It strips away hierarchy and reveals it for the lie that it is. There is no other. There's just no other. There's only us. That's it.
That's a very powerful statement, Bill. I mean, you know, I like that wounded monsters, that type of phrase. I think it does speak to us all being imperfect beings and constantly learning. You said that you've kind of felt like you missed out on some things, you know, in your past. You said you missed out. What do you mean by that?
Well, I was a misfit as a child. I was different in every way that a kid could be different. I was the fat kid, the smart kid, the ugly kid, the sissy kid in a small Southern town. And growing up in a time when all of those things were unusual and not good. And so I learned that I could either try to withdraw and disappear, but if you disappear, then the mean kids will try to find you. And they're mean because they were taught to be mean, but that's a whole other, you know, story. Or you can learn to entertain them. And if you scratch the surface, in my experience, if you scratch the surface of anybody who's worth a damn in this business, you'll find this kind of childhood, that the entertaining, whatever it is, always started out as a way to say, please don't hit me.
That's extremely empathic of you to say, right? That even it's easy enough to label people and say, oh, they're a bully, or, you know, they're always angry. But what you're really saying is, scratching beneath the surface, there's a wounded individual under each and every one of us almost.
That's exactly right. I mean, I was a kid, I didn't know that, but I did learn that if I could make them smile, they wouldn't hit me. And so I became the little performing monkey, which Yeah, which I liked. They would say, hey, Oberst, do that thing you do. And I would do an imitation of a teacher or principal or something and make them laugh. And they would go, you're okay. So, yeah, I found a way to be okay. Even though it was weird in a lot of ways, I found a way to be okay.
Yeah, there's a real power in that, it sounds like, that you found. So at what point did it translate into becoming a career?
Well, this is all I've ever done for a living and all I ever wanted to do. Although people said, you know, you won't be able to make a living. So when I went to college, they had something called J School, which is journalism school. It doesn't exist anymore, but it taught you how to be a television reporter and personality and all those things, because of course you weren't going to make it as an actor. So that was my college training, my camera training. And then I started doing stage, and I did stage for 14 years, primarily doing solo shows, taking great people of history in their own words and sort of creating this boiled down version of them. And then by accident, 13 years ago, I fell into film and television, and I've been doing that ever since, primarily in horror movies, because I have the face for it.
Well, so that's interesting. And you mentioned about the solo show, right? I definitely talk about your horror movie career, obviously, but talk about that. You know, what prompted you to do solo? I mean, you made a conscious decision to do that. It seems like that encompassed most of your stage career. Where did that motivation come from? What made you decide to do that?
It's the most frightening thing you can do. It's the edge of the cliffiest, edge of the diving boardiest thing you can do. It's ballsy, it's frightening, and it's very fraught with failure. I've failed many times. But Mark Twain said, there are things about audiences which cannot be taught. They can only be learned. And he was right. And you learn by failure, constant failure, a lot of failure. For one of these shows, the first 20 shows are horrible. I always feel terrible for the audience who comes to the first 20 shows. Then you start to kind of get the feel of it. And at 50 shows, you think, okay, I kind of got this. But at 100 shows, you realize, I don't know what I thought I knew. And it's only after you do maybe 500 performances of a particular show that you start to go, now I understand. But you learn to feel the audience. And I can't explain it any more deeply than that. You feel them. It's as if it's a first date back in the day when people dated. You take the temperature of the room. You feel it. Even though the words are going to be pretty much the same, there's a rhythm. And you feel, what do these people need tonight? Because the audience you're meeting is a collective person, and that person will never exist again in that configuration. Never. Even if you had the same people back an hour later, they would be different human beings because of things that have happened in their life in that hour. So it's a once in a lifetime opportunity to interact with a one-time collective person who will never exist again. So it's very tenuous, very tenuous. It's like a spider web. But that's why I wanted to do it, because I knew it was really hard. And then the harder it became and the more I failed, the more I wanted to do it until I could figure it out. And film and TV has been the same way for me. I learn by doing, not so much in the classroom. I like to make mistakes.
Yeah, so that's an interesting comment. And I've had guests on the show before who talked about failures, and you know, it's a way to learn. And a lot of people say that, and a lot of people say they subscribe to it, but the actual failing is difficult. It's a feeling that, you know, because as human beings, it's kind of goes against our nature. So I want to get, you know, your thoughts, especially whether other people are watching and listening. How are you able to cope with failure? I mean, what advice, you know, could people gain from you listening to you when you talk about how you've been able to learn and cope with failure?
Failure is your friend. I wholly disagree with the sentiment that it should be a rare thing or a thing that you brush under the rug or thing you hope doesn't happen. Hope for failure, people. Hope for it. Because if you don't fail at a task, if you do a task perfectly the first time, you're lying to yourself. You didn't do it perfectly. Okay. You will only learn to do a task by failing at it repeatedly. And you can go into the stereotypes of Thomas Edison. You failed 100 times. No, I've learned 100 ways that a light bulb doesn't work.
Sure.
But it's true. You must just get in and start failing. You'll fail to various degrees, and nobody else may even realize you're failing.
Sure.
But it's left brain, right brain, right? First, you are if I'm learning a piece of music and I'm a musician, I have to step out of the whole universe to learn how to do the fingering work for this particular piece. And it has to be very mechanical. Later, when it is mechanical, I can reintegrate it into the whole universe of the right brain, and then it becomes of a piece. But it's the same way with stage work and film work. You have to not only find your light and watch your voice modulation and understand where the character's coming from and watch your feet so you don't fall off the stage. You have to do all of those things at one time. And at first it's very mechanical. So yeah, I would say whether it's a cake recipe or learning to make concrete or doing a movie, you must fail. And if you don't, and you haven't failed, and you tell me I'm really good at what I do and I've never failed, I just don't trust you. And I don't want to work with you because I'm afraid of you, because I'm afraid that if you can't admit that you're wrong, I'm afraid you're going to fail massively, and it's going to happen with me involved and take me down. Wow. So stay away.
I love that. I love that sentiment. I mean, it's a powerful thing is what you're saying. It's not just live with failure. It sounds like, as you said, hope for and embrace failure. So I think that's very interesting and a powerful way to approach that. Now, you seem, again, in talking to you, you have a, you know, a grasp of history, you have a grasp of, you know, obviously you mentioned Mark Twain and obviously psychology as well. So a very intellectual approach. So where does that come from, Bill? Your intellectual...
Lonely kid. Okay. You're a lonely kid. Books are your friends. We had no internet. I was born even before VHS tapes. So literally you could fill your brains with The Price is Right on television, or you, which I did. I mean, like every other kid. Or you could read. And so the library became my friend. I was amazed at what was available in the library. And quickly I left the kids section and just started perusing or reading and ripping through that library. And so here's the amazing thing, Mark. In reading, early on, I read, I didn't really understand it, but I made myself read Plato and Socrates and the earliest Greek philosophers, and some of the Romans and stuff like, but what I learned was everything that I was feeling had already been felt. And this was a revelation. You fall in love, your heart's broken, go back. Read the Greeks. There are beautiful treatises on heartbreak by people whose hearts have been broken and they've been in the ground for thousands of years. This blew my mind because it meant that I was not the center of the universe, that everything, even though I am a unique individual, everything I can possibly experience has been experienced before by thousands, if not millions of other people. So it immediately made me feel less lonely because I'm just one little link in a historical chain of human beings. That's what reading did for me.
That is interesting. So yeah, basically you, as you said, it started off by being that lonely child, as you said, and you ended up just feeling connected to all of humanity, it sounds like, just through your reading.
Yes, you just put it. That is such a beautiful way to put it. You are connected to all humanity because the book is dead. The author is dead, but you open it up, and by entering into the world, once again, it lives. And they live, and their world lives, and you are at one with someone who you'll never meet. It's the strangest, most magical thing in the world. So in my business, a lot of times you'll mention a work of literature or something. They go, oh, I saw the movie. The movie is an entirely different creation because it's an entirely different media. It's not even remotely the same. Example, The Name of the Rose by Umberto Eco. One of my favorite books, the most difficult book I've ever read, still difficult when I reread it, but I love it. It's not the movie. The ideas in the book are very few of them are even in the movie. The movie is just a shell of the basic plot stripped down. But the book is rich and metaphoric. And I mean, you know what I mean. But I'm a big advocate of just reading and trying to read above your level. Take things down off the shelf that you think, I can't handle this, and try to handle it.
Well, and that's not the first time in this conversation you mentioned sort of jumping in the deep end, right? I mean, you chose to do the solo act because it's challenging. It sounds like you said it's the most challenging thing you can do as a performer. you're choosing to, as you said, read above your level. So where does that come from? Kind of constantly challenging yourself to things that are beyond your current scope.
Why else would you live?
Ah.
I mean, what's the point? If you're only reaching for things that you can grab, then life is just mechanical. It's just food and sex and cars and turning things off and turning things on and Alexa do this. And who wants a life like that?
Yeah.
You should always be grabbing for things that you're not sure you can put your arms around. That's the romance and the joy and the thrill of life.
Yeah. Beautifully said as well. I mean, again, it makes sense when you're saying it, but yet so many people are out there saying, I wish I could do this, or tomorrow I'll do this. And it's always putting things off. And then before you know it, your life is past. Interesting.
No tomorrow. No tomorrow.
That's a great way to say that. No, that's great, Bill. Thank you for sharing your perspective on that. Very unique and powerful perspective. So you said you fell into it by accident, horror movies. So talk a bit about that.
Well, I fell into movies and TV by accident entirely. And then the first thing I'd done on television was a docudrama on the History Channel called Sherman's March. And I was cast as William Sherman, just on a fluke. I'd never done an audition before.
Wow.
And so it was laughable. I used an old code I used for a Christmas Carol theatrical production, and I downloaded pictures of epaulets and taped them to the edge and dyed my hair red. And it was ridiculous, but they cast me. So then I thought, this is great. I really love history and I love historical dramas. I'll be a historical drama actor, but we don't need historical drama actors anymore. 30 years too late. So I went to LA and got myself a manager, and I was starving, absolutely starving.
Wow.
And then I went to an audition for a soccer dad. She kept sending me out for soccer dads, which is great. I'd love to be a soccer dad, but you know. So the casting director said, when we were done, said, can I tell you something? I said, yeah. He said, you are the soccer dad who's going to kill the team, dismember them and eat them. She said, you want to work? I said, yeah, go dark. I said, how dark? She said, with your face, you can't go dark enough. The camera will love you dark. So I instantly, and I love horror, and I have since I was a kid, so I changed all my marketing, everything online. I changed my headshots. I changed everything and started pursuing horror roles, and they came, and they haven't stopped.
Wow.
So I fell into film and TV by accident, and then I fell into horror by necessity. But it's been a tremendous gift to me, because it turns out the reason that I loved it as a kid is because it resonated with this idea of the wounded monster in me. So now I get to not only feel it, but play it.
Wow. I mean, that's an extremely powerful evolution to that point where you're actually playing that wounded monster. So interesting. And, you know, let's talk a bit about, you said you're starving when you were out there. I mean, you're, as again, somebody who constantly challenges yourself and you're constantly embracing failure, right? I mean, at what point, whenever you're struggling at LA, I mean, like, did you have any times whenever you were doubting this as a career move?
Oh, I cried all the time.
Okay.
I would cry and call home, and they'd be like, you wanted it, go get it. I was too ashamed to go get food from the food bank. And so a friend brought me a box, and all that peanut butter was so good. But I figured, there's a way to do this. I just need to find the mechanism. And so I looked for the levers. What are the levers? How do you do this? And I learned about creating a brand and became fascinated with how to do it. And so then I became more internet savvy than I should have been. But I got deep into it because I wanted to associate certain keywords with my name so they would pop up. And so forth and so on. And I just got obsessed, Mark, with the challenge, not of being a movie star, because I know I was never going to do that, but with the challenge of finding the levers to become a working LA actor. And finally did. And when a lever wouldn't work, I would say, okay, that one doesn't work, but this one does. And then I found my little set of levers that I could pull to make it work for me. But the hell of LA and the hell of show business in general is your levers don't work for anybody else. So people want you to tell them how to make it, I don't know, man. You got to find your own levers. That's tough.
That's a great way to say it. I love how you're, it's almost a scientific algorithm, you know, just a blueprint to kind of follow. But to your point, you have to color it in yourself with what makes you, you.
That's right. And the first time you go to a casting session and they say, ah, you're the one who blah, 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 because they saw your keywords online, which you had seeded yourself. Hmm. You're like, yes,
it worked.
Starting to work. LA is very insular, you know, the show business is very insular and they want what already is. Hmm. So if you come to them and you're not already something, they don't want to make you anything. They want to look for the thing that already is. And so you have to appear to be a thing that already is. You act as if, even though you're not. And then you are.
It's a great point. I mean, it's just fascinating what you're saying, you know, and again, I think time and time again, in talking to people in the business, sometimes if people aren't in the business, it looks easy, right? People are like, all right, I can go out and do this. But there's a lot of thought and again, science and art that goes into making it in the business.
And over 90% is just what I just said.
Yeah.
It's 90%. You have to, if you have a manager and the manager gets 10% of your pay, that means you're responsible for 90% of your career. Hmm. So most of your time is spent manipulating images of yourself and doing self-promotion and all of these sorts of things. And the more you do it, the more you appear to be already what you want to be. And the more people hire you to be that thing, and then it's self-confirming. But they will not hire you if they think you're not already the thing. Yeah, nobody's going to help you make it, quote unquote.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And I think, you know, we were earlier talking about Internet Movie Database, for instance. And I think everybody all goes out there and looks at that and says, is there anything out there? Does this person even have an IMDb page? So to your point, there's got to be something that exists so people have at least something to go on. Otherwise, as you said, why should they invest in you? They don't have time to invest in you and creating you.
I remember early on being Googled during a casting session. You know, you come in, state your name, and you'd see them, pop, 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 pop. They're scanning, pop. You might get like 10 seconds, pop. They're on your IMDb, pop. Okay, then they started the audition. So their primary impression of you in the internet age is not formed by what you're doing in the room. It's formed by what they could find online before you do anything in the room. And then your online stuff had better conform with what you're about to do for them. So then you're of a piece because they want a product.
Yeah, that's
a great. It's not enough just to be a talented actor, quote unquote. You have to know your stuff, but you also have to be a marketable product, because the only reason that, and this is getting down in the weeds of my business, but nobody will hire you above scale unless you bring value to their project.
That
Otherwise, why wouldn't they get a $100 a day actor?
Yeah.
The only reason they're going to hire you is if you bring, and so you have to show them how you're bringing added value to the project, and you do that by being a product.
Yeah, that's a fantastic point. And you know, and for those of you that are listening or watching and aren't in the industry, I mean, obviously that same methodology could apply to anything, right? It's just, what value do you bring to whoever you're trying to sell yourself to, basically sell yourself. So that's great.
And how do you not only meet but exceed your customers' expectations? Exceed them.
Yes.
I have many customers. At the moment, you're my customer. I have my producer is my customer, my director, but then every department head on that set, they're all my customer. When you get in front of the camera, that whole camera crew is your customer, the director, of course, and then ultimately you're serving the editor, you're serving sound, and you're serving the audience, but they're all your customers. So every single one of them needs something from you. And if you're servant based and you think, I'm a servant, how can I serve? How do I serve wardrobe? How do I serve editing? How do I serve sound? It's helpful.
You know, there's a lot of people that are in business that talk about servant leadership, but rarely have actually seen it. And what you're describing is essentially that. You're servant-based. You're looking at everybody on some level as your customer. And I think that's a remarkable approach, Bill. And I give you a lot of credit for that.
Well, it's the only way that I can work, because I'm not pretty. I'm not young. I'm not going to be a movie star, but I found my niche. And part of it, what I do on screen is a part of it, but also part of it is the way I behave on set, the things I bring to set. People know I'm not going to be a bitch. And so a lot of times I get hired in part because I'm not going to be a bitch, because they have the choice between me and another actor in my genre who can do the same thing, but who is sometimes, you know, difficult.
Sure.
And they know that I'm going to bring a servant attitude. And so, yeah, I can't afford to be a bitch because I won't work.
That is extremely well said. There's people in all sorts of industries who have a remarkable skill set, who have a lot of experience, but if they're not able to collaborate with others, then they don't get the work. So I think that's really well said. You know, as somebody who's constantly evolving, because you're constantly challenging yourself, is there a specific, like, what specific area would you most like to improve about yourself? I know it sounds like a job interview question, but I'm really curious about that, Bill. What's something you want to improve about yourself?
As I get older, keeping up my physicality becomes more difficult. And I need to push beyond what I have done. I've always, you know, I need to be lean and somewhat ripped for my work, because that's a part of my image. And as I grow older, you know, things settle. And so that's what I need to improve. I've already done it on my diet. I've stripped away everything processed. I am Mr. Whole Foods, but I need to step up. I mean, this sounds silly. What do you want to improve about yourself? Oh, cardio. It sounds very shallow, but it's a part of my job. So yeah, I need to improve my, start pushing myself more in physical fitness, and I'm going to do it. I'm going to have to do it, or I can't keep working.
Yeah, I think that's, I appreciate calling out your answer, but you're right. It's very purposeful. Your decision to improve your cardio and improve yourself is related to keeping you in the mode of what you want to do, what you're passionate about. So I think it makes a lot of sense.
Right. And as they say, I'm a product.
Yeah.
And I have to be the product that they bought. I can't say, well, I'm an older, less fit version of the product that you bought. And I can't really do the things that the product could do before, but we're good, right? No. I have to be the product. So, and I can be. It's just, you know, like everybody else, you settle. You're like, okay, this is good enough. But then you realize it's not settled. Like so many people, last year I had a bout of COVID. Despite all of my precautions, I got the damn thing.
Wow.
It kicked my butt. And so because of it, because of the fatigue afterwards, I didn't work out for a long time. Couldn't. And then when I started back up working out, I didn't hit it as hard as I did before because I was being gentle. But so I haven't yet taken off the training wheels, but they've got to go. Thank you for this question, because it just convicts me.
I mean, you're welcome. I mean, again, I'm on the mind that we all have, you know, I like to think about people, you know, people typically in our society look at other people as a glass half full of water. We look at other people at deficits and say, okay, that person, they need something. I need to fill up that glass of water. Whereas I'm looking at you, and anybody I talk to, typically I try to, as more like a well, and the water's inside, and it's up to me to ask questions to pull that water up to the surface. So the motivation is already within you. It's just a matter of you talking through it, and that's very powerful whenever you hear your own voice. So thank you for
confirming
this.
Yeah. You're very good at what you do. I hope somebody interviews you like this sometime.
Ah, well, I appreciate that. Thank you very much. You never know what may happen. So Bill, I think, you know, we're getting close to the 30-minute mark. And I guess maybe, you know, I was trying to think of a good question in the end, but maybe it's just a simple one, because you've already talked about your, you know, what motivates you. You already talk about just the living life by challenging yourself. I guess maybe the basic question is, what is next for Bill Oberst Jr.? What's next for you?
I hope something that I could not predict. I hope, because you get into the habit, you know, of saying, here's what I'll do tomorrow and this day and that day and that day. And of course, it will be a continuation of this thing, but life is never like that. Mm. It's always something different, and you never know when a shift or a reinvention is coming. So I hope that I hope it's something I could not predict. And if I had predicted, I'd look like a fool. Mm. That would be nice. it's very liberating to be proved a fool and to be proved wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Incredibly liberating, because then you realize, A, the burden of always being right is gone, and mm-hmm. B, nobody else will ever be right all the time either. And so it makes you, I think, a more graceful and giving, gentle person. You're more prone to forgive other people because they're as big a fool as you are.
Well, I think that attitude of empathy is definitely something that's pervasive in your life. And I think a lot of people could learn from that. So,
well,
yeah, Bill, yeah.
Life's for the living, you know?
Yeah.
Life is for the living. And in two ways, I mean, when you're dead, you're dead. That's it.
Yeah.
I spend a lot of time thinking about death because I work in it a lot. And, you know, people go to great lengths to try to preserve a legacy for themselves, but eventually it goes. The people who know you are dead. You will not be known. So you cannot outlive this life. You won't outlive this life.
Right.
So life is for the living, and live it, because you don't know when it'll end. Well, that was a cliche.
No, it's okay. The fact that you identify that as a cliche just speaks to your emotional intelligence and the way that you're just very intellectual in your approach. And it was a real pleasure to talk with you today, Bill. And thank you for sharing your perspective.
It was my pleasure. Thank you, Mark.
Bless you. Oh, my gosh. Yes, thank you. Well, again, I want to, of course, thank the listeners and viewers out there who tuned in today as we discussed a lot of fantastic things with Bill. And so on behalf of Bill Obers Jr., this is Mark DeValenti signing off for Brain Burrow. Have an amazing rest of your day.
You just dug deep with Mark D. Do you want more? Follow Mark on Instagram @ValentiHorror and subscribe to the Brain Burrow podcast.